This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Holy Blood, Holy Grail by Michael Bergent, Richard Lee, and Henry Lincoln. Read for you by Simon Preble. Part 1. The Mystery. At the start of our search, we didn't know precisely what we were looking for that matter, looking at. We had no theories and no hypotheses, and we had set out to prove nothing. On the contrary, we were simply trying to find an explanation for a curious little enigma of the late 19th century. The conclusions we eventually reached were not postulated in advance. We were led to them, step by step, as if the evidence we accumulated had a mind of its own, was directing us of its own accord. We believed, at first, that we were dealing with a strictly local mystery, an intriguing mystery certainly, but a mystery of essentially minor significance, confined to a village in the south of France. We believed that our investigation might help to illumine certain aspects of Western history, but we never dreamed that it might entail rewriting them. Still less did we dream that whatever we discovered could be of any real contemporary relevance, and explosive contemporary relevance at that. Our quest began with a more or less straightforward story. At first glance, this story was not markedly different from numerous other treasure stories or unsolved mysteries which abound in the history and folklore of almost every rural region. A version of it had been publicized in France, where it attracted considerable interest, but was not, to our knowledge at the time, accorded any inordinate consequence. As we subsequently learned, there were a number of errors in this version. For the moment, however, we must recount the tale as it was published during the 1960s, and as we first came to know of it. On June the 1st, 1885, the tiny French village of Rennes-le-Château received a new parish priest. The curé's name was Béranger Saunière. He was a robust, handsome, energetic, and it would seem, highly intelligent man, aged 33. In seminary school, he had seemed destined for a promising clerical career. Certainly, he had seemed destined for something more important than a remote village in the eastern foothills of the Pyrenees. Yet at some point, he seems to have incurred the displeasure of his superiors. What precisely he did, if anything, remains unclear, but it soon thwarted all prospects of advancement. And it was, perhaps, to rid themselves of him that his superiors sent him to the parish of Rennes-le-Château. At the time, Rennes-le-Château housed only 200 people. It was a tiny hamlet perched on a steep mountaintop, approximately 25 miles from Carcassonne. To another man, the place might have constituted exile, a life sentence in a remote provincial backwater. No doubt it was a blow to Saunière's ambition. Nevertheless, there were certain compensations. Saunière was a native of the region, having been born and raised only a few miles distant. Between 1885 and 1891, Saunière's income averaged pretty much what one would expect for a rural curé in late 19th century France. Together with gratuities provided by his parishioners, it appears to have been sufficient. During those 6 years, Saunière seems to have led a pleasant enough life, and a placid one. He hunted and fished in the mountains and streams of his boyhood. He read voraciously, perfected his Latin, learned Greek, embarked on the study of Hebrew. He employed, as housekeeper and servant, an 18-year-old peasant girl named Marie Desnano, who was to be his lifelong companion and confidant. He paid frequent visits to his friend, the Abbé Henri Boudet, curé of the neighbouring village of Rennes-les-Bains, and under Boudet's tutelage, he immersed himself in the turbulent history of the region, a history whose residues were constantly present around him. A few miles to the southeast of Rennes-le-Château, for example, looms another peak called Bizou, surmounted by the ruins of a medieval fortress, which was once a preceptory of the Knights Templar. On a third peak, a mile or so east of Rennes-le-Château, stands the ruins of the Château of Blanchefort, ancestral home of Bertrand de Blanchefort, fourth Grand Master of the Knights Templar, who presided over that famous order in the mid-12th century. Rennes-le-Château and its environs had been on the ancient pilgrim route, which ran from northern Europe to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, and the entire region was steeped in evocative legends, in echoes of a rich, dramatic, and often blood-soaked past. For some time, Saunier had wanted to restore the village church of Rennes-le-Château. Consecrated to the Madeleine in 1059, this dilapidated edifice stood on the foundations of a still older Visigoth structure dating from the 6th century. By the late 19th century, it was, not surprisingly, in a state of almost hopeless disrepair. In 1891, encouraged by his friend Boudet, Saunier embarked on a modest restoration, borrowing a small sum from the village funds. In the course of his endeavours, he removed the altar stone, which rested on two archaic Visigoth columns. One of these columns proved to be hollow. Inside, the curé found four parchments preserved in sealed wooden tubes. Two of these parchments are said to have comprised genealogies, one dating from 1244 and the other from 1644. The two remaining documents had apparently been composed in the 1780s by one of Saunier's predecessors as curé of Rennes-le-Château, the Abbé Antoine Bigou. Bigou had also been personal chaplain to the noble Blanchefort family, who on the eve of the French Revolution were still among the most prominent local landowners. The two parchments from Bigou's time would appear to be pious Latin texts, excerpts from the New Testament, at least ostensibly. But on one of the parchments, the words are run incoherently together, with no space between them, and a number of utterly superfluous letters have been inserted. And on the second parchment, lines are indiscriminately truncated, unevenly, sometimes in the middle of a word, while certain letters are conspicuously raised above the others. In reality, these parchments comprise a sequence of ingenious ciphers or codes. Some of them are fantastically complex, insoluble without the requisite key. The following decipherment has appeared in French works devoted to Rennes-le-Château. Shepherdess, no temptation, that Poussin, Tenier, hold the key. Peace, 681. By the cross and this horse of God, I complete or destroy this demon of the guardian at noon. Blue apples. But if some of the ciphers are daunting in their complexity, others are obvious. In the second parchment, for instance, the raised letters, taken in sequence, spell out a coherent message. To Dagobert the Second, King, and to Sion, belongs this treasure, and he is there, dead. Although this particular message must have been discernible to Saunier, it is doubtful that he could have deciphered the more intricate codes. Nevertheless, he realized he had stumbled upon something of consequence, and with the consent of the village mayor, brought his discovery to his superior, the Bishop of Carcassonne. How much the bishop understood is unclear, but Saunier was immediately dispatched to Paris, at the bishop's expense, with instructions to present himself and the parchments to certain important ecclesiastic authorities. Chief among these were the Abbé Biet, Director General of the Seminary of Saint-Sulpice, and Biet's nephew, Émile Offay. At the time, Offay was training for the priesthood. Although still in his early 20s, he had already established an impressive reputation for scholarship, especially in linguistics, cryptography, and paleography. Despite his pastoral vocation, he was known to be immersed in esoteric thought, and maintained cordial relations with the various occult-oriented groups, sects and secret societies which were proliferating in the French capital. Having presented himself to Biet and Offay, Cernier spent 3 weeks in Paris. What transpired during his meetings with the ecclesiastics is unknown. What is known is that the provincial country priest was promptly and warmly welcomed into Offet's distinguished circle. During his stay in Paris, Cernier also spent some time in the Louvre. This may well be connected with the fact that before his departure, he purchased reproductions of 3 paintings. One seems to have been a portrait by an unidentified artist of Pope Celestin V, who reigned briefly at the end of the 13th century. One was a work by David Tenier, although it's not clear which David Tenier, father or son. The third was perhaps the most famous tableau by Nicolas Poussin, Les Bergers d'Acadie, The Shepherds of Arcadia. On his return to Rennes-le-Château, Cernier resumed his restoration of the village church. In the process, he exhumed a curiously carved flagstone dating from the 7th or 8th century, which may have had a crypt beneath it, a burial chamber in which skeletons were said to have been found. Cernier also embarked on projects of a rather more singular kind. In the churchyard, for example, stood the sepulchre of Marie, Marquise de Poule de Blanchefort. The headstone and flagstone marking her grave had been designed and installed by the Abbé Antoine Bigot, Cernier's predecessor of a century before, who had apparently composed 2 of the mysterious parchments. Not knowing that the inscription on the Marquise's tomb had already been copied, Cernier obliterated them. Nor was this desecration the only curious behaviour he exhibited. Accompanied by his faithful housekeeper, he began to make long journeys on foot about the countryside, collecting rocks of no apparent value or interest. He also embarked on a voluminous exchange of letters with unknown correspondents throughout France, as well as in Germany, Switzerland, Italy, Austria, and Spain. He took to collecting stacks of utterly worthless postage stamps, and he opened certain shadowy transactions with various banks. One of them even dispatched a representative from Paris, who travelled all the way to Rennes-le-Château for the sole purpose of ministering to Cernier's business. In postage alone, Cernier was already spending a substantial sum, more than his previous annual income could possibly sustain. Then, in 1896, he began to spend in earnest on a staggering and unprecedented scale. By the end of his life in 1917, his expenditure would amount to the equivalent of several £1 million at least. Some of this unexplained wealth was devoted to laudable public works. A modern road was built leading up to the village, for example, and facilities for running water were provided. Other expenditures were more quixotic. A tower was built, the Tour Magdala, overlooking the sheer side of the mountain. An opulent country house was constructed, called the Villa Bethania, which Cernier himself never occupied. And the church was not only redecorated, but redecorated in a most bizarre fashion. Immediately inside the entrance, a hideous statue was erected, a gaudy representation of the demon Asmodeus, custodian of secrets, guardian of hidden treasures, and according to ancient Judaic legend, builder of Solomon's temple. On the church walls, lurid, garishly painted plaques were installed depicting the stations of the cross. Each was characterized by some odd inconsistency, some inexplicable added detail, some flagrant or subtle deviation from accepted scriptural account. In Station 8, for example, there is a child swathed in a Scottish plaid. In Station 14, which portrays Jesus' body being carried into the tomb, there is a background of dark nocturnal sky, dominated by a full moon. It is almost as if Cernier were trying to intimate something. But what? That Jesus' burial occurred after nightfall, several hours later than the Bible tells us it did? Or that the body is being carried out of the tomb, not into it? While engaged in this curious adornment, Cernier continued to spend extravagantly. He collected rare china, precious fabrics, antique marbles. He created an orangery and a zoological garden. He assembled a magnificent library. Nor were his parishioners neglected. Saunière regaled them with sumptuous banquets and other forms of largesse, maintaining the lifestyle of a medieval potentate presiding over an impregnable mountain domain. In his remote and well-nigh inaccessible Erie, he received a number of notable guests. One was the French Secretary of State for Culture, but perhaps the most august and consequential visitor to the unknown country priest was the Archduke Johann von Habsburg, a cousin of Franz Joseph, Emperor of Austria. Bank statements subsequently revealed that Saunière and the Archduke had opened consecutive accounts on the same day, and that the latter had made a substantial sum over to the former. The ecclesiastical authorities at first turned a blind eye. When Saunière's former superior at Carcassonne died, however, the new bishop attempted to call the priest to account. Saunière responded with startling and brazen defiance. He refused to explain his wealth. He refused to accept the transfer the bishop ordered. Lacking any more substantial charge, the bishop accused him of simony, illicitly selling masses, and a local tribunal suspended him. Saunière appealed to the Vatican, which exonerated and reinstated him. On January 17, 1917, Saunière, then in his 65th year, suffered a sudden stroke. The date of January the 17th is perhaps suspicious. The same date appears on the tombstone of the Marquise de Poul de Blanchefort, the tombstone Saunière had eradicated. And January the 17th is also the feast day of Saint Sulpice, who, as we were to discover, figured throughout our story. It was at the seminary of Saint Sulpice that he confided his parchments to the Abbé Biet and Émile Offet. But what makes Saunière's stroke on January the 17th most suspicious is the fact that 5 days before, on January the 12th, his parishioners declared that he had seemed to be in enviable health for a man of his age. Yet on January the 12th, according to a receipt in our possession, Marie Denano had ordered a coffin for her master. As Saunière lay on his deathbed, a priest was called from a neighbouring parish to hear his final confession and administer the last rites. The priest duly arrived and retired into the sick room. According to eyewitness testimony, he emerged shortly thereafter, visibly shaken. The priest, presumably on the basis of Saunière's confession, refused to administer extreme unction. On January the 22nd, Saunière died unshriven. The following morning, his body was placed upright in an armchair on the terrace of the Tour Magdala, clad in an ornate robe adorned with scarlet tassels. One by one, mourners filed past, many of them plucking tassels of remembrance from the dead man's garment. There has never been any explanation of this ceremony. The reading of Saunière's will was awaited with great anticipation. To everyone's surprise and chagrin, however, it declared him to be utterly penniless. At some point before his death, he had apparently transferred the whole of his wealth to Marie Denano, who had shared his life and secrets for 32 years. Following the death of her master, Marie continued to live a comfortable life in the Villa Bethania until 1946. After the Second World War, however, the newly installed French government issued a new currency. As a means of apprehending tax evaders, collaborators, and wartime profiteers, French citizens, when exchanging old francs for new, were obliged to account for their revenues. Confronted by the prospect of an explanation, Marie chose poverty. She was seen in the garden of the villa burning vast sheaves of old franc notes. For the next 7 years, Marie lived austerely, supporting herself on money obtained from the sale of Villa Bethania. She promised the purchaser, Monsieur Noël Courbou, that she would confide to him, before her death, a secret which would make him not only rich but also powerful. On January the 29th, 1953, however, Marie, like her master before her, suffered a sudden and unexpected stroke, which left her prostrate on her deathbed, incapable of speech. To Monsieur Courbet's intense frustration, she died shortly thereafter, carrying her secret with her. This, in its general outlines, was the story published in France during the 1960s. This was the form in which we first became acquainted with it, and it was to the questions raised by the story in this form that we, like other researchers of the subject, addressed ourselves. The first question is fairly obvious. What was the source of Saunier's money? Whence could such sudden and enormous wealth have come? Was the explanation ultimately banal, or was there something more exciting involved? We began by considering the explanations suggested by other researchers. According to many of these, Saunier had indeed found a treasure of some kind. This was a plausible enough assumption, for the history of the village and its environs includes many possible sources of hidden gold or jewels. The Cathar heretics, for example, were reputed to possess something of fabulous and even sacred value, which, according to a number of legends, was the Holy Grail. There was also the vanished treasure of the Knights Templar, whose Grand Master, Bertrand de Blanchefort, commissioned certain mysterious excavations in the vicinity. There were other possible treasures as well. Between the 5th and 8th centuries, much of modern France was ruled by the Merovingian dynasty, which included King Dagobert II. Rennes-le-Château in Dagobert's time was a Visigoth bastion, and Dagobert himself was married to a Visigoth princess. The town might have constituted a sort of royal treasury, and there are documents which speak of great wealth amassed by Dagobert for military conquest and concealed in the environs of Rennes-le-Château. If Saunier discovered some such depository, it would explain the reference in the codes to Dagobert. The Cathars, the Templars, Dagobert II. And there was yet another possible treasure, the vast booty accumulated by the Visigoths during their tempestuous advance through Europe. This might have included something more than conventional booty, possibly items of immense relevance, both symbolic and literal, to Western religious tradition. It might, in short, have included the legendary treasure of the Temple of Jerusalem. Treasure, then, may well have been the source of Saunier's unexplained wealth. The priest may have discovered any of several treasures, or he may have discovered a single treasure which repeatedly changed hands through the centuries, passing perhaps from the Temple of Jerusalem to the Romans to the Visigoths, eventually to the Cathars and or the Knights Templar. If this were so, it would explain why the treasure in question belonged both to Dagobert II and to Sion. Thus far, our story seemed to be essentially a treasure story, and a treasure story is ultimately of limited relevance and significance. People are constantly discovering treasures of one kind or another. Such discoveries are often exciting, dramatic, and mysterious. Few of them, however, exercise any direct influence on the present. Unless, of course, the treasure includes a secret of some sort. We did not discount the argument that Saunier discovered treasure. At the same time, it seemed clear to us that mere money, gold, or jewels would not explain a number of facets to his story. They would not account for his introduction to Ophir's circle, for instance. They would not explain the church's intense interest in the matter, the impunity with which Saunier defied his bishop, or his subsequent exoneration by the Vatican, which seemed to have displayed an urgent concern of its own. They would not explain a priest's refusal to administer the last rites to a dying man, or the visit of a Habsburg archduke to a remote little village in the Pyrenees. Nor would money, gold, or jewels explain the powerful aura of mystification surrounding the whole affair, from the elaborate coded ciphers to Marie Denano burning her inheritance of banknotes. And Marie herself had promised to divulge a secret which conferred not merely wealth, but power as well. Could Cernier's wealth have come not from anything of intrinsic financial value, but from knowledge of some kind? If so, could this knowledge have been turned to fiscal account? Could it have been used to blackmail somebody, for example? Could Cernier's wealth have been his payment for silence? We knew that he had received money from Johann von Habsburg. At the same time, his relations with the Austrian Archduke, according to all accounts, were notably cordial. On the other hand, there was one institution which, throughout Saunier's later career, seems to have been distinctly afraid of him. The Vatican. Could Saunier have been blackmailing the Vatican? Granted, such blackmail would be a presumptuous and dangerous undertaking for one man, however exhaustive his precautions. But what if he were aided and supported in his enterprise by others, like the French Secretary of State for Culture, or the Habsburgs? What if the Archduke Johann were only an intermediary, and the money he bestowed on Saunier actually issued from the coffers of Rome? In February 1972, The Last Treasure of Jerusalem, the first of our three films on Saunier and the Mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, was shown. The film made no controversial assertions. It simply told the basic story as it has been recounted here. Not surprisingly, perhaps, we received a veritable deluge of mail. Some of it offered intriguing speculative suggestions. Some of it was complimentary. Some of it was dotty. Of all these letters, one seemed to warrant special attention. It came from a retired Anglican priest. Our correspondent wrote with categorical certainty and authority. The treasure, he declared flatly, did not involve gold or precious stones. On the contrary, it consisted of incontrovertible proof that the crucifixion was a fraud and that Jesus was alive as late as A.D. 45. This claim sounded flagrantly absurd. What could possibly comprise incontrovertible proof that Jesus survived the crucifixion? We were unable to imagine anything which could not be disbelieved or repudiated. At the same time, the sheer extravagance of the assertion begged for clarification and elaboration. The writer of the letter had provided a return address. At the earliest opportunity, we drove to see him. In person, he was rather more reticent than he had been in his letter, and seemed to regret having written to us in the first place. He refused to expand upon his reference to incontrovertible proof, and volunteered only one additional fragment of information. This proof, he said, or its existence at any rate, had been divulged to him by another Anglican cleric, Canon Alfred Leslie Lilly. Lilly, who died in 1940, had published widely and was not unknown. During much of his life, he had maintained contacts with the Catholic modernist movement based primarily at Saint-Sulpice in Paris. In his youth, Lilly had worked in Paris and had been acquainted with Émile Hoffé. The trail had come full circle. Given a connection between Lilly and Hoffé, the claims of the priest, however preposterous, could not be summarily dismissed. Similar evidence of a monumental secret was forthcoming when we began to research the life of Nicolas Poussin, the great 17th-century painter whose name recurred throughout Saunier's story. In 1656, Poussin, who was living in Rome at the time, had received a visit from the Abbé Louis Fouquet, brother of Nicolas Fouquet, superintendent of finances to Louis XIV of France. From Rome, the abbé dispatched a letter to his brother describing his meeting with Poussin. Part of this letter is worth quoting. "He and I discussed certain things which I shall with ease be able to explain to you in detail, things which will give you, through Monsieur Poussin, advantages which even kings would have great pains to draw from him, and which, according to him, it is possible that nobody else will ever rediscover in the centuries to come. And what is more, these are things so difficult to discover that nothing now on this earth can prove of better fortune nor be their equal. Neither historians nor biographers of Poussin or Fouquet have ever been able satisfactorily to explain this letter, which clearly alludes to some mysterious matter of immense import. Not long after receiving it, Nicolas Fouquet was arrested and imprisoned for the duration of his life. The whole of his correspondence was confiscated by Louis XIV, who inspected all of it, personally. In the years that followed, the king went determinedly out of his way to obtain the original of Poussin's painting, Les Bergers d'Arcadie. When he at last succeeded, it was sequestered in his private apartments at Versailles. Whatever its artistic greatness, the painting would seem to be innocent enough. In the foreground, three shepherds and a shepherdess are gathered about a large antique tomb, contemplating the inscription in the weathered stone, Et in Arcadia ego. In the background looms a rugged, mountainous landscape of the sort generally associated with Poussin. According to Anthony Blunt, as well as other Poussin experts, this landscape was wholly mythical, a product of the painter's imagination. In the early 1970s, however, an actual tomb was located, identical to the one in the painting. Identical in setting, dimensions, proportions, shape, surrounding vegetation, even in the circular outcrop of rock on which one of Poussin's shepherds rests his foot. This actual tomb stands on the outskirts of a village called Arche, approximately 6 miles from Rennes-le-Château, and 3 miles from the Château of Blanchefort. If one stands before the sepulchre, the vista is virtually indistinguishable from that in the painting. And then it becomes apparent that one of the peaks in the background of the painting is Rennes-le-Château. There is no indication of the age of the tomb. According to local farmers, the tomb has been there for as long as they, their parents and grandparents, can remember. When preparing the first of our BBC films on Rennes-le-Château, we spent a morning shooting footage of the tomb. We broke off for lunch and returned some 3 hours later. During our absence, a crude and violent attempt had been made to smash into the sepulchre. If there was once an inscription on the actual tomb, it had long since been weathered away. As for the inscription on the tomb in Poussin's painting, it would seem to be conventionally elegiac, death announcing his sombre presence even in Arcadia, the idyllic pastoral paradise of classical myth. And yet, the inscription is curious, because it lacks a verb. Literally translated, it reads, And in Arcadia, I... dot, dot, dot. Why should the verb be missing? Perhaps for a philosophical reason, to preclude all tense, all indication of past, present, or future, and thereby to imply something eternal? Or perhaps for a reason of a more practical nature. The codes in the parchments found by Saunier had relied heavily on anagrams, on the transposition and rearrangement of letters. Could et in Arcadia ego also perhaps be an anagram? Could the verb have been omitted so that the inscription would consist only of certain precise letters? One of our television viewers, in writing to us, suggested that this might indeed be so, and then rearranged the letters into a coherent Latin statement. The result was, Itego arcana Dei. Be gone, I conceal the secrets of God. We were pleased and intrigued by this ingenious exercise. We did not realize at the time how extraordinarily appropriate the resulting admonition was. We began our investigation at a point with which we already had a certain familiarity, the Cathar or Albigensian heresy and the crusade it provoked in the 13th century. In 1209, an army of some 30,000 knights and foot soldiers from northern Europe descended like a whirlwind on the Languedoc, the mountainous northeastern foothills of the Pyrenees, in what is now southern France. In the ensuing war, the whole territory was ravaged. Crops were destroyed, towns and cities were razed, a whole population was put to the sword. In the town of Béziers alone, at least 15,000 men, women and children were slaughtered wholesale, many of them in the sanctuary of the church itself. when an officer inquired of the Pope's representative how he might distinguish heretics from true believers, the reply was, "Kill them all. God will recognize his own." This quotation may be apocryphal. However, it typifies the fanatical zeal and bloodlust with which the atrocities were perpetrated. After Béziers, the invading army swept through the whole of the Languedoc, and wherever the victors passed, they left a trail of blood, death, and carnage in their wake. This war, which lasted for nearly 40 years, is now known as the Albigensian Crusade. It was a crusade in the true sense of the word. It had been called by the Pope himself. Its participants wore a cross on their tunics, like crusaders in Palestine, and the rewards were the same as they were for crusaders in the Holy Land: remission of all sins, an expiation of penances, an assured place in heaven, and all the booty one could plunder. By the time the crusade was over, the Languedoc had been utterly transformed, plunged back into the barbarity that characterized the rest of Europe. Why? For what had all this havoc, brutality, and devastation occurred? At the beginning of the 13th century, the area now known as the Languedoc was not officially a part of France. It was an independent principality, whose language, culture, and political institutions had less in common with the north than they had with Spain. The principality was ruled by a handful of noble families, and within the confines of this principality there flourished a culture which, at the time, was the most advanced and sophisticated in Christendom, with the possible exception of Byzantium. The Languedoc had much in common with Byzantium. Learning, for example, was highly esteemed, as it was not in northern Europe. Philosophy and other intellectual activities flourished. Poetry and courtly love were extolled. Greek, Arabic, and Hebrew were enthusiastically studied. And at Lunel and Narbonne, schools devoted to the Kabbalah, the ancient esoteric tradition of Judaism, were thriving. Even the nobility was literate and literary, at a time when most northern nobles could not even sign their names. Like Byzantium too, the Languedoc practiced a civilized, easygoing religious tolerance, in contrast to the fanatical zeal that characterized other parts of Europe. Skeins of Islamic and Judaic thought, for instance, were imported through maritime commercial centers like Marseille, or made their way across the Pyrenees from Spain. At the same time, the Roman Church enjoyed no very high esteem. Roman clerics in the Languedoc, by virtue of their notorious corruption, succeeded primarily in alienating the populace. There were churches, for example, in which no mass had been said for more than 30 years. Many priests ignored their parishioners and ran businesses or large estates. One archbishop of Narbonne never even visited his diocese. Whatever the corruption of the church, the Languedoc had reached an apex of culture that would not be seen in Europe again until the Renaissance. But, as in Byzantium, there were elements of complacency, decadence, and tragic weakness which rendered the region unprepared for the onslaught subsequently unleashed upon it. For some time, both the northern European nobility and the Roman Church had been aware of its vulnerability and were eager to exploit it. The northern nobility had, for many years, coveted the wealth and luxury of the Languedoc, and the church was interested for its own reasons. In the first place, its authority in the region was slack, and while culture flourished in the Languedoc, something else flourished as well, the major heresy of medieval Christendom. In the words of church authorities, the Languedoc was infected by the Albigensian heresy, the foul leprosy of the south. And although the adherents of this heresy were essentially non-violent, they constituted a severe threat to Roman authority. By 1200, there was a very real prospect of this heresy displacing Roman Catholicism as the dominant form of Christianity in the Languedoc. And what was more ominous still in the church's eyes, it was already radiating out to other parts of Europe. The heretics were known by a variety of names. In 1165, they had been condemned by an ecclesiastical council at the Languedoc town of Albi. For this reason, or perhaps because Albi continued to be one of their centres, they were often called Albigensians. On other occasions, they were called Cathars, or Catharese, or Cathari. Albigensian and Cathar were essentially generic names. They did not refer to a single coherent church, like that of Rome, with a fixed, codified, and definitive body of doctrine and theology. The heretics in question comprised a multitude of diverse sects, many under the direction of an independent leader whose followers would assume his name. And while these sects may have held to certain common principles, they diverged radically from one another in detail. In general, the Cathars subscribed to a doctrine of reincarnation and to a recognition of the feminine principle in religion. The preachers and teachers of Cathar congregations, known as Parfes, meaning perfected ones, were of both sexes. The Cathars rejected the Orthodox Catholic Church and denied the validity of all clerical hierarchies, or official and ordained intercessors between man and God. At the core of this position lay an important Cathar tenet, the repudiation of faith, at least as the Church insisted on it. In the place of faith accepted at second hand, the Cathars insisted on direct and personal knowledge, a religious or mystical experience apprehended at first hand. This experience had been called gnosis, from the Greek word for knowledge, and for the Cathars it took precedence over all creeds and dogma. Given such an emphasis on direct personal contact with God, priests, bishops, and other clerical authorities became superfluous. The Cathars were also dualists. All Christian thought, of course, can ultimately be seen as dualistic, insisting on a conflict between two opposing principles, good and evil, spirit and flesh, higher and lower. But the Cathars carried this dichotomy much further than Orthodox Catholicism was prepared to. For the Cathars, a perpetual war was being waged throughout the whole of creation between two irreconcilable principles, light and darkness, spirit and matter, good and evil. Catholicism posits one supreme God, whose adversary, the devil, is ultimately inferior to him. The Cathars, however, proclaim the existence not of one God, but of two, with more or less comparable status. One of these gods, the good one, was entirely disincarnate, a being or principle of pure spirit, unsullied by the taint of matter. He was the god of love. But love was deemed wholly incompatible with power, and material creation was a manifestation of power. Therefore, for the Cathars, material creation, the world itself, was intrinsically evil. The universe was the handiwork of a usurper god, the god of evil, or as the Cathars called him, Rex Mundi, king of the world. According to some Cathars, the purpose of man's life on earth was to transcend matter, to renounce perpetually anything connected with the principle of power, and thereby to attain union with the principle of love. According to other Cathars, man's purpose was to reclaim and redeem matter, to spiritualize and transform it. In the eyes of the Roman Church, the Cathars were committing serious heresies in regarding material creation, on behalf of which Jesus had supposedly died, as intrinsically evil, and implying that God, whose word had created the world in the beginning, was a usurper. Their most serious heresy, however, was their attitude towards Jesus himself. Since matter was intrinsically evil, the Cathars denied that Jesus could become incarnate in the flesh and still be the Son of God. By some Cathars, he was therefore deemed to be wholly incorporeal, a phantasm, an entity of pure spirit, which of course could not possibly be crucified. The majority of Cathars seem to have regarded him as a prophet, no different from any other, a mortal being who, on behalf of the principle of love, died on the cross. There was nothing mystical, nothing divine about the crucifixion, if indeed it was relevant at all, which many Cathars appear to have doubted. In any case, all Cathars vehemently repudiated the significance of both the crucifixion and the cross. The cross was regarded as an emblem of Rex Mundi, Lord of the material world, the very antithesis of the true redemptive principle. Jesus, if mortal at all, had been a prophet of amor, the principle of love. And amor, when inverted or perverted or twisted into power, became Roma, Rome. whose opulent, luxurious church seemed to the Cathars a palpable embodiment and manifestation on earth of Rex Mundi's sovereignty. It's intellectually fashionable nowadays to regard the Cathars as a congregation of sages, enlightened mystics, or initiates in arcane wisdom. In actual fact, however, most Cathars were more or less ordinary men and women who found in their creed a refuge from the endless tithes, penances, obsequies, strictures, and other impositions of the Roman Church. However abstruse their theology, the Cathars were eminently realistic people in practice. They condemned procreation, for example, since the propagation of the flesh was a service not to the principle of love, but to Rex Mundi. But they were not so naive as to advocate the abolition of sexuality. True, there was a specific Cathar sacrament, or the equivalent thereof, called the consolamentum, which compelled one to chastity. Except for the parfaits, however, the consolamentum was not administered until one was on one's deathbed, and it's not inordinately difficult to be chaste when one is dying. How does one condemn procreation while condoning sexuality? There is evidence to suggest that the Cathars practiced both birth control and abortion. Generally, the Cathars seem to have adhered to a life of extreme devotion and simplicity. Deploring churches, they usually conducted their rituals and services in the open air or in any readily available building. They also practiced what we today would call meditation. They were strict vegetarians, although the eating of fish was allowed. This, then, was the creed which swept the Languedoc on a scale that threatened to displace Catholicism itself. By 1200, Rome had grown distinctly alarmed by the situation, nor was she unaware of the envy with which the barons of northern Europe regarded the rich lands and cities to the south. This envy could readily be exploited, and the northern lords would constitute the church's storm troops. All that was needed was some excuse to ignite popular opinion. Such an excuse was soon forthcoming. On January the 14th, 1208, one of the papal legates to the Languedoc, Pierre de Castelnau, was murdered. The crime seems to have been committed by anti-clerical rebels with no Cathar affiliations whatever. However, Rome did not hesitate to blame the Cathars. At once, Pope Innocent III ordered a crusade. A massive army was mustered under the command of the abbot of Citeaux. Military operations were entrusted largely to Simon de Montfort, and under Simon's leadership, the Pope's crusaders set out to reduce the highest European culture of the Middle Ages to destitution and rubble. In this holy undertaking, they were aided by a new and useful ally, a Spanish fanatic named Dominique Guzman. Spurred by a rabid hatred of heresy, Guzman in 1216 created the monastic order subsequently named after him, the Dominicans, and in 1233 the Dominicans spawned a more infamous institution, the Holy Inquisition. In 1218, Simon de Montfort was killed besieging Toulouse, but the depredation of the Languedoc continued, with only brief respites for another quarter of a century. By 1243, all major Cathar towns and bastions had fallen to the northern invaders, except for a handful of remote and isolated strongpoints. Chief among these was the majestic mountain citadel of Montségur, poised like a celestial arc above the surrounding valleys. For 10 months, Montségur was besieged by the invaders, withstanding repeated assaults and maintaining tenacious resistance. At length, in March 1244, the fortress capitulated, and Catharism, at least ostensibly, ceased to exist in the south of France. During the Albigensian Crusade, and afterwards, a mystique grew up around the Cathars which still persists today. In part, this can be put down to the element of romance that surrounds any lost and tragic cause. But at the same time, we discovered there were some very real mysteries associated with the Cathars. While the legends might be exalted and romanticized, a number of enigmas remained. One of these pertains to the legendary Cathar treasure. It's known that the Cathars were extremely wealthy. Technically, their creed forbade them to bear arms, and though many ignored this prohibition, the fact remains that large numbers of mercenaries were employed at considerable expense. At the same time, the sources of Cathar wealth, the allegiance they commanded from powerful landowners, for instance, were obvious and explicable. Yet rumours arose, even during the course of the Albigensian Crusade, of a fantastic, mystical Cathar treasure, far beyond material wealth. Whatever it was, this treasure was reputedly kept at Montségur. When Montségur fell, however, nothing of consequence was found, and yet there are certain extremely singular incidents connected with the siege and the capitulation of the fortress. During the siege, the attackers numbered upwards of 10,000. With this vast force, the besiegers attempted to surround the entire mountain, precluding all entry and exit, and hoping to starve out the defenders. Despite their numerical strength, however, they lacked sufficient manpower to make their ring completely secure. Many troops were local, moreover, and sympathetic to the Cathars, and many troops were simply unreliable. In consequence, it was not difficult to pass undetected through the attackers' lines. There were many gaps through which men slipped to and fro, and supplies found their way up to the fortress. The Cathars took advantage of these gaps. In January, nearly 3 months before the fall of the fortress, two Parfaits escaped. According to reliable accounts, they carried with them the bulk of the Cathars' material wealth, a load of gold, silver, and coin, which they carried first to a fortified cave in the mountains, and from there to a castle stronghold. After that, the treasure vanished, and has never been heard of again. On March 1st, Montségur finally capitulated. By then, its defenders numbered less than 400. Between 150 and 180 of them were Parfaits, the rest being knights, squires, men-at-arms, and their families. They were granted surprisingly lenient terms. The fighting men were to receive full pardon for all previous crimes. They would be allowed to depart with their arms, baggage, and any gifts, including money, they might receive from their employers. The Parfaits were also accorded unexpected generosity, provided they abjured their heretical beliefs and confessed their sins to the Inquisition. They would be freed and subjected only to light penances. The defenders requested a 2-week truce with a complete halt to hostilities to consider the terms. In a further display of uncharacteristic generosity, the attackers agreed. In return, the defenders voluntarily offered hostages. It was agreed that if anyone attempted to escape from the fortress, the hostages would be executed. Were the Parfaits so committed to their beliefs that they willingly chose martyrdom instead of conversion? Or was there something they could not, or dared not, confess to the Inquisition? Whatever the answer, not one of the Parfaits, as far as is known, accepted the besiegers' terms. On the contrary, all of them chose martyrdom. Moreover, at least 20 of the other occupants of the fortress, 6 women and some 15 fighting men, voluntarily received the consolamentum and became Parfaits as well, thus committing themselves to certain death. On March 15th, the truce expired. At dawn the following day, more than 200 Parfaits were dragged roughly down the mountainside. Not one recanted. There was no time to erect individual stakes, so they were locked into a large wood-filled stockade at the foot of the mountain and burned en masse. Confined to the castle, the remainder of the garrison was compelled to look on. They were warned that if any of them sought to escape, it would mean death for all of them, as well as for the hostages. Despite this risk, however, the garrison had connived in hiding 4 Parfaits among them, and on the night of March 16th, these 4 men, accompanied by a guide, made a daring escape, again with the knowledge and collusion of the garrison. They descended the sheer western face of the mountain, suspended by ropes, and letting themselves down drops of more than 100 meters at a time. What were these men doing? What was the purpose of their hazardous escape, which entailed such risk to both the garrison and the hostages? On the next day they could have walked freely out of the fortress, at liberty to resume their lives. Yet for some unknown reason, they embarked on a perilous nocturnal escape which might easily have entailed death for themselves and their colleagues. According to tradition, these 4 men carried with them the legendary Cathar treasure. But the Cathar treasure had been smuggled out of Montségur 3 months before, and how much gold, silver, or coin could 3 or 4 men carry on their backs dangling from ropes on a sheer mountainside? If the 4 escapees were indeed carrying something, it would seem clear that they were carrying something other than material wealth. What might they have been carrying? Accoutrements of the Cathar faith, perhaps. Books, manuscripts, secret teachings, relics, religious objects of some kind. Perhaps something which, for one reason or another, could not be permitted to fall into hostile hands. But if something of so precious a nature had to be kept out of hostile hands, why was it not smuggled out before? Why was it retained in the fortress until this last and most dangerous moment? The precise date of the truce permitted us to deduce a possible answer to these questions. It had been requested by the defenders, who voluntarily offered hostages to obtain it. For some reason, the defenders seemed to have deemed it necessary, even though all it did was delay the inevitable for a mere 2 weeks. Perhaps, we concluded, such a delay was necessary to purchase time. Not time in general, but that specific time, that specific date. It coincided with the spring equinox, and the equinox may well have enjoyed some ritual status for the Cathars. It's known that a festival of some sort was held on March the 14th, the day before the truce expired. There seems little doubt that the truce was requested in order that this festival might be held, and there seems little doubt that the festival could not be held on a date selected at random. It apparently had to be on March 14th. Whatever the festival was, it clearly made some impression on the hired mercenaries, some of whom, defying inevitable death, converted to the Cathar creed. Could this fact hold at least a partial key to what was smuggled out of Montségur 2 nights later? Could whatever was smuggled out then have been necessary in some way for the festival on the 14th? Could it somehow have been instrumental in persuading at least 20 of the defenders to become parfaits at the last moment? And could it, in some fashion, have ensured the subsequent collusion of the garrison, even at the risk of their lives? If the answer is yes to all these questions, that would explain why whatever was removed on the 16th was not removed earlier, in January, for example, when the monetary treasure was carried to safety. It would have been needed for the festival, and it would then have had to be kept out of hostile hands. As we pondered these conclusions, we were constantly reminded of the legends linking the Cathars and the Holy Grail. We were not prepared to regard the Grail as anything more than myth. We were certainly not prepared to assert that it ever existed in actuality. Even if it did, we couldn't imagine that a cup or bowl, whether it held Jesus's blood or not, would be so very precious to the Cathars, for whom Jesus, to a significant degree, was incidental. Still, the legends continue to haunt and perplex us. They must also, we concluded, have haunted Saunière, who was, after all, steeped in the legends and folklore of the region. And like any other native of the region, Saunière must have been constantly aware of the proximity of Montségur, whose poignant and tragic fate still dominates local consciousness. But for Saunière, the very nearness of the fortress may well have entailed certain practical implications. Something had been smuggled out of Montségur just after the truce expired. According to tradition, the 4 men who escaped from the doomed citadel carried with them the Cathar treasure. But the monetary treasure had been smuggled out 3 months earlier. Could the Cathar treasure, like the treasure Saunière discovered, have consisted primarily of a secret? Could that secret have been related in some unimaginable way to something that became known as the Holy Grail? In any case, whatever was smuggled out of Montségur had to have been taken somewhere. According to tradition, it was taken to the fortified caves of Ornolac in the Ariège, where a band of Cathars was exterminated shortly after. But nothing, save skeletons, has ever been found at Ornolac. On the other hand, Rennes-le-Château is only half a day's ride on horseback from Montségur. Whatever was smuggled out of Montségur might well have been brought to Rennes-le-Château, or more likely, to one of the caves which honeycomb the surrounding mountains. And if the secret of Montségur was what Saunier subsequently discovered, that would obviously explain a great deal. In the case of the Cathars, as with Saunier, the word treasure seems to hide something else, knowledge or information of some kind. Given the tenacious adherence of the Cathars to their creed and their militant antipathy to Rome, we wondered if such knowledge or information related in some way to Christianity. Was it possible that the Cathars knew something, something that contributed to the frenzied fervour with which Rome sought their extermination? At the time, we could only speculate idly, and information on the Cathars was, in general, so meagre that it precluded even a working hypothesis. On the other hand, our research into the Cathars had repeatedly impinged on another subject, even more enigmatic and mysterious, and surrounded by evocative legends. This subject was the Knights Templar. To research the Knights Templar proved a daunting undertaking. The voluminous quantity of written material devoted to the subject was intimidating, and we could not at first be sure how much of this material was reliable. If the Cathars had engendered a welter of spurious and romantic legend, the mystification surrounding the Templars was even greater. On one level, they were familiar enough to us, the fanatically fierce warrior monks, knight mystics clad in white mantle with splayed red cross, who played so crucial a role in the Crusades. Here, in some sense, were the archetypal Crusaders, the stormtroopers of the Holy Land, who fought and died heroically for Christ in their thousands. Yet, at the end of their two-century-long career, these white-garbed champions of Christ were accused of denying and repudiating Christ, of trampling and spitting on the cross. In Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, the Templars are depicted as haughty and arrogant bullies, greedy and hypocritical despots, shamelessly abusing their power, cunning manipulators orchestrating the affairs of men and kingdoms. By other 19th-century writers, they are depicted as vile Satanists, devil worshippers, practitioners of all manner of obscene, abominable, and/or heretical rites. More recent historians have been inclined to view them as hapless victims, sacrificial pawns in the high-level political manoeuvrings of church and state. And there are yet other writers, especially in the tradition of Freemasonry, who regard the Templars as mystical adepts and initiates, custodians of an arcane wisdom that transcends Christianity itself. Who and what were the Knights Templar? So far as is generally known, the first historical information on the Templars is provided by a Frankish historian, Guillaume de Thier, who wrote between 1175 and 1185. This was at the peak of the Crusades, when Western armies had already conquered the Holy Land and established the Kingdom of Jerusalem. By the time Guillaume de Thier began to write, Palestine had been in Western hands for 70 years, and the Templars had already been in existence for more than 50. Guillaume was therefore writing of events which he'd not personally witnessed or experienced, but had learnt of at second or even third hand. Guillaume's chronicles are certainly useful, but it is a mistake, and one to which many historians have succumbed, to regard them as unimpugnable. According to Guillaume de Thier, the Order of the Poor Knights of Christ and the Temple of Solomon was founded in 1118. Its founder is said to be one Hugues de Payon, a nobleman from Champagne and a vassal of the Count of Champagne. One day, Hugues, unsolicited, presented himself with eight comrades at the palace of Baudouin I, King of Jerusalem, whose elder brother, Godefroy de Bouillon, had captured the holy city 19 years before. The declared objective of the Templars, Guillaume de Thier continues, was, as far as their strength permitted, they should keep the roads and highways safe with a special regard for the protection of pilgrims. So worthy was this objective that the king placed an entire wing of the royal palace at the knights' disposal. And despite their declared oath of poverty, the knights moved into this lavish accommodation. According to tradition, their quarters were built on the foundations of the ancient Temple of Solomon. And from this, the fledgling order derived its name. For 9 years, Guillaume de Thier tells us the nine knights admitted no new candidates to their order. They were still supposed to be living in poverty, such poverty that official seals show two knights riding a single horse, implying not only brotherhood, but also penury that precluded separate mounts. This style of seal is often regarded as the most famous and distinctive of Templar devices, descending from the first days of the order. However, it actually dates from a full century later, when the Templars were hardly poor, if indeed they ever were. According to Guillaume de Thiers, the Templars were established in 1118 and moved into the king's palace, presumably sallying out from there to protect pilgrims on the Holy Land's highways and byways. And yet, there was at this time an official royal historian employed by the king. His name was Fulk de Chartres, and he was writing during the very years in question. Fulk de Chartres makes no mention whatever of Hugues de Payon, his companions, or anything even remotely connected with the Knights Templar. Certainly, there is no record of them doing anything to protect pilgrims, and one cannot but wonder how so few men could hope to fulfil so mammoth a self-imposed task. 9 men to protect the pilgrims on all the thoroughfares of the Holy Land? Only 9? And all the pilgrims? If this was their objective, one would surely expect them to welcome new recruits. Yet according to Guillaume de Thiers, they admitted no new candidates to the order for 9 years. Nonetheless, within a decade, the Templars' fame seems to have spread back to Europe. By 1128, or shortly thereafter, a tract, lauding their virtues and qualities, was issued by no less a person than Saint Bernard, abbot of Clairvaux, and the age's chief spokesman for Christendom. Bernard's tract, in praise of the new knighthood, declares the Templars to be the epitome and apotheosis of Christian values. After 9 years in 1127, most of the 9 knights returned to Europe, and a triumphal welcome orchestrated in large part by Saint Bernard. In January 1128, a church council was convened at Troyes. At this council, the Templars were officially recognized and incorporated as a religious military order. Hugues de Payon was given the title of Grand Master. He and his subordinates were to be warrior monks, soldier mystics, combining the austere discipline of the cloister with a martial zeal tantamount to fanaticism. A militia of Christ, as they were called at the time. The Templars were sworn to poverty, chastity, and obedience. They were obliged to cut their hair, but forbidden to cut their beards, thus distinguishing themselves in an age when most men were clean-shaven. Diet, dress, and other aspects of daily life were stringently regulated in accordance with both monastic and military routines. All members of the order were obliged to wear white habits or surcoats and cloaks, and these soon evolved into the distinctive white mantle for which the Templars became famous. In addition, the rule established a loose administrative hierarchy and apparatus, and behaviour on the battlefield was strictly controlled. If captured, for instance, Templars were not allowed to ask for mercy or to ransom themselves. They were compelled to fight to the death. Nor were they permitted to retreat unless odds against them exceeded 3-1. In 1139, a papal bull was issued by Pope Innocent II. According to this bull, the Templars would owe allegiance to no secular or ecclesiastical power other than the Pope himself. In other words, they were rendered totally independent of all kings, princes, and prelates, and all interference from both political and religious authorities. During the 2 decades following the Council of Troyes, the order expanded with extraordinary rapidity and on an extraordinary scale. Throughout Europe, younger sons of noble families flocked to enroll in the order's ranks, and vast donations in money, goods, and land were made from every quarter of Christendom. Hugues de Payon donated his own properties, and all new recruits were obliged to do likewise. On admission to the order, a man was compelled to sign over all his possessions. Within a mere 12 months of the Council of Troyes, the order held substantial estates in France, England, Scotland, Flanders, Spain, and Portugal. Within another decade, it also held territory in Italy, Austria, Germany, Hungary, the Holy Land, and points east. Although individual knights were bound to their vow of poverty, this did not prevent the order from amassing wealth and on an unprecedented scale. In 1146, the Templars adopted the famous splayed red cross, the Cross Patay. With this device emblazoned on their mantles, the knights accompanied King Louis VII of France on the Second Crusade. Here they established their reputation for martial zeal, coupled with an almost insane foolhardiness and a fierce arrogance as well. On the whole, however, they were magnificently disciplined, the most disciplined fighting force in the world at the time. The French king himself wrote that it was the Templars alone who prevented the Second Crusade, ill-conceived and mismanaged as it was, from degenerating into a total debacle. During the next 100 years, the Templars became a power with international influence. They were constantly engaged in high-level diplomacy between nobles and monarchs throughout the Western world and the Holy Land. In England, for example, the Master of the Temple was regularly called to the King's Parliament and was regarded as head of all religious orders, taking precedence over all priors and abbots in the land. Nor was the order's political involvement confined to Christendom alone. Close links were forged with the Muslim world as well, and the Templars commanded a respect from Saracen leaders exceeding that accorded any other Europeans. On almost every political level, the Templars acted as official arbiters in disputes, and even kings submitted to their authority. In 1252, Henry III of England dared to challenge them, threatening to confiscate certain of their domains. "You Templars have so many liberties and charters that your enormous possessions mark you rave with pride and haughtiness. What was imprudently given must therefore be prudently revoked, and what was inconsiderately bestowed must be considerately recalled." The Master of the Order replied, "So long as thou dost exercise justice, thou wilt reign, but if thou infringe it, thou wilt cease to be king." It's difficult to convey to the modern mind the enormity and audacity of this statement. Implicitly, the master is taking a power that not even the papacy dared to explicitly claim, the power to make or depose monarchs. At the same time, the Templars' interests extended beyond war, diplomacy, and political intrigue. In effect, they created and established the institution of modern banking. By lending vast sums to destitute monarchs, they became the bankers for every throne in Europe, and for certain Muslim potentates as well. With their network of preceptories throughout Europe and the Middle East, they also organized, at modest interest rates, the safe and efficient transfer of money for merchant traders, a class which became increasingly dependent upon them. And the Templars traded not only in money, but in thought as well. Through their sustained and sympathetic contact,